From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Imagine you're in your car and you hit some traffic, but you don't have to lift a finger because your self-driving car slows down on its own. The U.S. Army Aberdeen Test Center in Maryland was recently designated by the federal government a site for trying out self-driving cars. Steve Kusiemba, an engineer and member of Maryland's workgroup on autonomous vehicles, says we're entering a transition period that's likely to take decades. He describes what it's like to ride in a self-driving car.
And all of a sudden, the driver took his hands off the wheel and feet off the pedals, and we were navigating right next to trucks and buses and cars going at full speed down the highway.
It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Don't worry about steering, braking, navigating. The self-driving car promises to do it all. This month, the Federal Department of Transportation designated the U.S. Army Aberdeen Test Center as one of 10 cleared sites for testing self-driving cars. Maryland had also proposed that I-95 around Baltimore and the central part of the state should be a test ground for self-driving cars, but the federal agency said no to that. So you won't be seeing self-driving cars on your commute anytime soon, but how far away are we from this technology? Joining me to discuss the opportunities and challenges presented by this emerging technology is Steve Kusiemba. He's vice president at the international engineering and consulting firm WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff. He's an intelligent transportation systems engineer and a member of the Maryland Department of Transportation's Autonomous and Connected Vehicle Working Group. Steve Kusiemba, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sheila. How are you?
I'm fine. So you're an intelligent engineer or you are an intelligent transportation systems engineer or both?
Let's call it intelligent transportation systems engineer and we'll stop right there.
What kind of timeline are we looking at? How soon should we expect the road to be filled with self-driving cars?
If you characterize it as the road being filled with it, that's a couple decades down the road still.
If you
characterize it as elements of our driving tasks being automated, it's happening today already. On my drive here, my car has a lane departure warning system, and the steering wheel starts to put me back in the lane if I wander out of the lane. I have a smart cruise control, an adaptive cruise control, where it can maintain a certain following distance between cars. So already, certain aspects of the driving task are automated. It's just a matter of continuing to automate them until everything, and you're sitting in the back seat reading the newspaper.
So push that a step further. When you talk about self-driving cars, what do you mean?
In the industry, there is no clear definition of what self-driving car actually means yet because it's still evolving. The driving task is made up of thousands of different little actions that you take every minute when you're on the road. And we're looking at ways to automate them to improve safety, to improve convenience. And when we talk about driverless vehicles, what we're talking about is a collection of automated tasks starting to work together.
Of your car, which apparently is newer than mine, pulling you back into the lane, mm-hmm. or if you start to get out of the lane. No one would call that a driverless car, a self-driving
Correct.
Car.
Correct. But it is technology that is there to improve safety and to improve convenience. If all of the cars are maintaining the same following distance from each other, you're going to have fewer traffic jams. Many traffic jams are caused simply by people operating at different speeds in the same lane. They come up on each other too fast, they slam on the brakes. The person behind them slams on the brakes. The person behind them slams on the brakes. If you eliminate that slamming on the brakes and every vehicle maintains the same following distance, you're going to have less congestion. You're going to have less stop-and-go traffic. When you have less congestion, you have fewer accidents. So just safety and convenience can be achieved simply by that one function of driving down the freeway. You may have heard the term platooning, vehicles platooning together, going down much like a train would go down, except for they're not connected by steel, they're connected by technology. And they're going down all at the same pace, maintaining the same following distance, maintaining a safe following distance all along the way. And that can improve the reliability of your travel. It can improve the safety of your travel. And if we're not sitting in congestion, there's an environmental benefit as well.
I want to get back to all of that, but I want to ask you first. The Washington Post reported that 9 states and Washington, D.C. already have enacted legislation regarding self-driving cars. Where would you rank Maryland in terms of progress on this front?
It's hard to rank any state as far as progress because every state is doing something right now. And I'm very proud as a resident of Maryland that I think our state is doing quite a bit right now. You mentioned at the top of the show that I am part of Maryland Department of Transportation's Connected and Automated Vehicle Working Group, which Secretary Ron established a little over a year ago.
Transportation Secretary.
Yes, and that working group is tackling the many different issues. There's many different issues to consider when you're talking about connected and automated vehicles. Everything from driver licensing, vehicle registration, permitting of testing, permitting of other activities. There's many different issues to tackle along the way. And Maryland is doing a fantastic job of raising all these issues, talking about them, talking with members of the industry about it. They applied for that U.S. Department designation, U.S. DOT designation you mentioned. And while they didn't get it along the I-95 corridor, and Aberdeen did, there still will be testing that could go on. Now, that testing could be certain components of a vehicle that is automated, certain tasks of the driving that could be automated, testing certain pieces. And it could be testing on I-95, it could be testing on US-1, or it could be tested in a parking lot at BWI, someplace off the beaten path where there are no other vehicles. The bottom line is that Maryland is very open to working with companies that want to test this technology.
But I must say, when I have thought about self-driving cars, I haven't thought of it as something state by state. But I would have thought that there is sort of a national move toward the technology that will be self-driving cars.
Well, there actually is quite a big national movement right now. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is part of the U.S. DOT, Department of Transportation, NHTSA is that regulatory group. That's the body that regulates vehicles and safety. And they've had a lot of interest in this area for a couple decades now. NHTSA recognizes that this technology could be a real game changer in reducing some of the 32,000 fatalities we have every year on our nation's highways. There are estimates of 80% of non-impaired accidents could be eliminated through technology. And that's why this is so exciting right now. And this is what gets me all passionate about it at the national level. There is a lot going on right now. At the state level, that's where driver's licensing and driver education takes place. At the national level, this is where you have your automakers, your big tech companies like Google and Apple that are engaging in all of this discussion. And all of the states are collectively working together and learning from each other. Maryland is part of several national working groups that are talking about all the issues and that are studying it and trying to figure out lessons learned. You asked me to rank Maryland. You can't really rank it, but what you can say is that each state is learning at different paces, and we can learn from each other.
That's Steve Kusiemba here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He is of the engineering and consulting firm WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff. We're talking about the opportunities and challenges presented by self-driving cars. So I want to get back to what you were saying about the incremental parts of technology that keep cars from colliding, keep people safer. Is getting to a fully self-driving car, a fully driverless car, just going to be the increment of adding those bits and pieces of technology, or is it something entirely different?
It is the cumulative effect of the bits and pieces of technology that will get us there. However, there are going to be lower speed applications, transit applications, shuttle services, and in low speed situations where we could go directly to a driverless vehicle in a year or less. There's already several vehicles being tested in low speed situations, such as large parking lots, campuses, large employment centers, where you could have a little 8-passenger vehicle, completely driverless shuttle, that could move people to and from one place or another.
Do we have that already in Maryland?
That technology exists. In Maryland, it's being tested right now down at the National Harbor. down by the new MGM Casino and National Harbor shopping area. There's a company called Local Motors that's been working with IBM, the big computer giant that we all are familiar with. And they've been testing a vehicle called the Ollie. And this little vehicle, it's a little 8-passenger shuttle. It doesn't go more than 15 miles an hour, but it can move around the streets of National Harbor without a driver. There's an operator that's monitoring it. This is still in testing phase right now, but it could easily be available very soon.
It moves around the streets of National Harbor in southern Prince George's County because it's on a track?
Nope. It is all technology. It uses a combination of GPS, the global positioning satellite that our cars and phones use for navigation today, a combination of GPS and what's called dead reckoning, just understanding where it is, and through cameras and sensors and radar and lasers, understanding exactly where it is in the environment around itself. Through all of that combination, you program a route ahead of time, and it follows that route until you change it ahead of time.
But its speed changes. I mean, it makes stops and it skips stops if there's no one there to get on or off.
Exactly. Much like you can hail an Uber today or a Lyft with your mobile device, you'll be able to hail this device through your mobile phone, and you'll be able to hail a ride from the Ollie down at National Harbor. It also has, like I mentioned, radar and LIDAR systems on it. So if a pedestrian or an object jumps out in front of it, it will stop itself.
LIDAR. What is LIDAR?
LIDAR is light-emitting radar, essentially. It's using laser for radar to be able to determine its surroundings, to be able to essentially map out 100 times a second everything around it, what's going on.
Have you ridden in a self-driving car?
I've ridden in a low-speed shuttle, much as I just described the Ollie. I've ridden in a couple different ones around the country. And then I've ridden in a high-speed driverless vehicle. When I was in Japan a couple years ago, Toyota had a vehicle. We were driving down a freeway at freeway speeds, a four-lane freeway, and all of a sudden the driver took his hands off the wheel and feet off the pedals, and we were navigating right next to trucks and buses and cars going at full speed down the highway. It was a little bit of a white-knuckle experience for me. It took me a little bit of getting used to.
And this was several years ago, you said?
This was two years ago, yes.
So we need to take a quick break in a minute. But before we do that, can you give me an overview sense of what it is that needs to change from adding these increments of my car sensing, your car sensing when it's getting out of the lane? What hurdles need to get crossed to get from that to an actual self-driving car?
Oh, there's many. The biggest hurdle is time. The average vehicle exists in this world for 11 to 12 years. It may have multiple owners during that 11 or 12 years, but it exists for 11 or 12 years. To filter through all of those vehicles and get a complete United States fleet of vehicles that are all automated will take time. People are going to part with their vehicles at a different pace than everyone else. Urban versus rural is going to be different. East Coast versus West Coast versus the middle of the country, they're going to approach it different. The uses of vehicles are going to be approached differently. So our biggest hurdle is time for the complete fleets to turn over. But it will eventually happen.
Okay, speaking of time, we are going to take a quick break here. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, how will self-driving cars know if there is a backup a half mile ahead or if there's a cyclist coming around the corner? We're going to talk with Steve Kusiemba about the communication hurdles self-driving cars will have to overcome. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. A solution to car accidents and distracted driving, an opportunity to sit back and relax. Self-driving cars appear to be the future of transportation, but how will they communicate with roads and bridges across different makes of cars, across state lines? I'm speaking with Steve Kusiemba. He's vice president at the International Engineering and Consulting firm WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff and a member of the Maryland Department of Transportation's Autonomous and Connected Vehicle Work Group. So, Steve, your expertise is in the communications aspect of autonomous vehicles. What does that encompass?
Communications is really the foundation for what's going to make connected and automated vehicles work in the future. Again, if you have a vehicle that all by itself knows what's going on right around the immediacy of the vehicle, that's fine. But now if it knows what's going on two vehicles ahead, three vehicles ahead, around the corner, up around the bed, a mile away, now you have a true system, a true network, where all of the vehicles can communicate and flow more freely and safely. So communication is that foundation that really puts it all together. Vehicles communicating with each other and with the roadside have the promise to virtually eliminate accidents. If two cars are approaching an intersection and they're communicating electronically with each other, theoretically, they should not crash. If one car is encroaching on the lane of another car, theoretically, if they're communicating, it should not crash.
Does that kind of technology already exist in cars?
It's beginning to roll out the production lines just this year. General Motors is putting it in a few of its models. The technology has been in testing and development for almost two decades now. It was in 1999 that the FCC authorized a segment of bandwidth at 5.9 gigahertz, which they allowed specifically for intelligent transportation systems use. And the technology is very similar to Wi-Fi. It's a short distance sort of communication. It's called Dedicated Short Range Communications, DSRC. It's an acronym that we in the business throw around a lot because it is a protected bandwidth. It is a very, what we call low latency, very quick communication. You know, there's no breaks. It's not like when you're on your cell phone and there's a little bit of a break or you drop a call or you have a little bit of a problem. With DSRC, it's immediate communication. 10 times, 100 times a second, you're able to communicate back and forth. Why is that important? Safety, data. If two vehicles are going 60 miles an hour and approaching a head-on collision, you can't afford to have the call dropped. You can't afford to have a gap. You need to have that 100 times a second communication. And that's what this technology allows.
And you're describing cars communicating with each other. What about my car communicating with the road?
Absolutely.
Same technology?
If they can communicate with each other, they can communicate with the road.
So the road is going to be sending a signal?
The road will be sending signals, again, whether it's at an intersection, whether it's the traffic signal that's communicating out its current status, I'm green, I'm yellow, I'm red, I'm about to turn green, I'm about to turn red. That technology exists. My company was part of a big test in Ann Arbor, Michigan, home to the University of Michigan, where I'm a proud alum as well. And we did a huge test, 3,000 vehicles in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we had several long corridors of traffic signals equipped with this communication technology, where it was broadcasting the signal phase and timing, understanding when the signal's going to turn red, when it's going to turn green, and the vehicles were able to be aware of that information. The technology is proven that it works. And in fact, the U.S. Department of Transportation, just before President Obama left office, put out a notice of rulemaking that auto manufacturers shall include this communication technology in their vehicles. Many of the automakers were already heading in that direction, and now there's a proposed regulation that they shall include that technology in there. As vehicles begin to get more of the technology, how do we get more of it on the roadside? I mentioned intersections. There's also along freeways you can put it. There's other places where we can broadcast information. Why is that important? Well, as you're approaching a curve, it might be valuable to broadcast, hey, there's a curve here, and you know what? This curve is not designed for anything more than 45 miles an hour. Today, you see signs that tell you to slow down. Well, what if your vehicle knows a half mile ahead of time, I'm going to have to slow down because there's a curve up there? Now you've reduced the potential for human error because your vehicle knows it has to slow down as it approaches that curve.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with transportation expert Steve Kusiemba of the engineering and consulting firm WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff, and we're talking about self-driving cars. So I can kind of begin to picture what the driving environment would be like when all vehicles are self-driving and they're all operating off this kind of communication. What about the situation as we're getting there, when you still have some vehicles at any given moment controlled by humans and some self-driving?
That's what I call the transition period. The next couple decades will be a transition period where we will have a mix of computer-operated and human-driven vehicles sharing the roads together. Whether it's a low speed or a high speed, a freeway or your side street or your parking lot, for the next couple decades, we're going to have a mixture of vehicles and operations out there. There's no easy way to put this other than it's going to be a learning experience. I wish I could say that it's going to be perfect, but it's not. We may discover that we need dedicated lanes to separate automation versus non-automated vehicles. There's several tests going on right now at the national level that are using computer models to determine if that makes sense. And what is the threshold? What percentage of automated vehicles do we need to have out there before we start having dedicated lanes? We may look differently at how we design cities and urban landscapes. If a car can go from place to place, drop off and pick up, and not need to be parked, maybe we don't need as many parking lots and parking garages. That could be green space. If vehicles are not crashing as often, perhaps that we don't need as many police and fire and emergency dedicated to just freeways and highways. Maybe we don't need emergency rooms staffed as big as we do right now because cars are not crashing as much. We're going to learn a lot over the next couple decades till we get to that utopia where everything is automated.
But even when we get to a place where all the vehicles are running on technology, you're still going to have pedestrians. You're going to have human beings crossing streets, and that's still going to be a level of uncertainty that the vehicle is going to have to be able to cope with. I mean, is this essentially a form of artificial intelligence that each of these vehicles are going to need?
Absolutely it is, yes. There's a level of AI right now that is being explored for just what you mentioned, pedestrians and bicyclists mixing with vehicles of a different nature. When you go around the world, you see a wide variety of how pedestrians and vehicles interact. Here in the United States, we're fairly consistent with pedestrians cross at crosswalk, generally when they're supposed to, and generally they don't cross in the middle of a high freeway. But you go around the globe, and that's not always the case. There are many cities and countries around the world where pedestrians and bicyclists and different types of vehicles and horse and buggy and trucks and tanks and cars, they all share the same roadway. And it's going to be a challenge for vehicle manufacturers to get the level of AI necessary where we are 100% safe. It's going to take some time. But we're heading in the right direction, and I do believe that eventually we'll get to that point where technology will guide us. It'll either guide the vehicle to understand that there is a pedestrian ahead, and therefore there's a level of uncertainty, and you, Mr. Person, sitting in the car, just pay attention because A, you might have to take over for me, or B, I may have to slam on the brakes because there's some uncertainty ahead.
That's not truly driverless then, if the car is counting on me, the human, to jump in.
You're right.
For the emergency.
You're right. And for a number of years, we're going to probably be in that situation where the human has to still be able to take over in certain situations. In the industry, we have levels of automation, level 0 through 5. And the federal government actually put out some guidance and they adopted levels that were put forth by the Society of Automotive Engineers. Level 5 is the truly driverless where no one ever has to interfere with it. Level 2 is where we are today with things like cruise control and some of the technology that we have. Level 3 is where I mentioned we have smart cruise control and lane keeping and things like that. Level 3 and 4 is where we'll be for the next several years, where a human may still have in certain situations to step in whether it's your last mile of your commute, whether it's pulling in and out of your driveway. There may be certain situations where a human still has to interface. That's going to take some time. So that does make this even more confusing, where we're eventually going to that fully driverless, what I just called level 5, but it's going to take several decades where all of the vehicles are fully level 5 driverless. And during that time, we're going to have a complete mixture of automation and human-driven vehicles.
I'm not going to take my eyes off the road. I appreciate your giving us this overview. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Steve Kusiemba is a vice president at the international engineering and consulting firm WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff. He is an intelligent transportation systems, ITS, engineer, and a member of the Maryland Department of Transportation's Autonomous and Connected Vehicle Working Group. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Kast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.